Today on Movie Royale, as we talk about day three of our coverage of the Tribeca Film Festival 2016. Live from New York, it's time for Movie Wallahs. Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theaters on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. And this is Joe here.
It's Rashmi.
And Yazzie as well.
So we are well and truly movied to death.
Wow.
We've really been working hard, actually, at this film festival.
Yep.
I think we covered 5 movies on day 1, 6 on day 2, and today, day 3...
We've topped it.
7 movies between the three of us. We're kind of sat here. It's Saturday night, and we're all a little bleary-eyed, but nonetheless, better off for it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, we are like...
Entertained, educated.
Yeah. Kids in a candy shop. Although we are starting to get a bit of a sugar high.
Yes. Yes. And my jeans are getting tighter for all the food we're eating.
Well, it's been kind of junky, hasn't it? I mean...
But good.
I've been junky. I mean, New York has got so many culinary delights. And what do I do in the morning? I grab a donut.
Well, I think
and a damn good one that was this morning.
I think my average time from the end of one movie to rushing to the start of new movies about between 3 and 5 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
It's so, literally enough to head to the restroom.
Bio break.
Yeah, bio break and just rush to the next movie. So they're back to back.
Yeah.
So then you end up starving and you eat everything inside when you can.
Correct.
Such, you know, poor us at this wonderful
yeah.
film.
Woe is us. Yes. The horror.
So let's get started with Women Who Kill.
Okay, so Women Who Kill is written, directed, and stars Ingrid Jungerman. And the plot goes, commitment-phobic Morgan and her ex-girlfriend Jean, locally famous true crime podcasters, suspect Morgan's new love interest is a murderer. It's as simple as that. So, Joe, what did you think of this one?
Well, so going into this, actually, Rashmi, I think this was one that you had highlighted, but I hadn't even read the description, so I was going in pretty cold with this one, which can often happen at a film festival, but... sometimes it's
I just drag you along.
Well, no, sometimes it's a delight. I mean, I do like the experience of watching films without any preconceived ideas and you let it unravel in front of you. That was very much the case here. And I spent the first couple of minutes scratching my head. I mean, the movie, you know, is a comedy, but with a title of Women Who Kill, which becomes sort of apparent within the first couple of minutes. I was wondering where it might go. In the end, I can say I was genuinely pleased with what I ended up with here. This is a very quirky, bizarrely original comedy, the likes of which I can't quite say I've seen before. It has an unusual tone to it. It's very much set in the LGBT community, which, again, I think it's kind of a backdrop to the movie. It doesn't really... These characters could be heterosexual, homosexual. It's irrelevant, but they just don't happen to be homosexual. And what we get is kind of a weird, you know, murder, mystery, thriller, comedy, bizarre genre mashup. The likes of which, again, I think I haven't seen before. And I ended up enjoying this one way more than I thought I would.
Yes, Dee.
Yeah, the dialogue in this movie is amazing. I mean, she, the lead actor, she wrote and directed the movie as well.
Ingrid Jungerman.
And she's such an unusual person. I mean, and you're absolutely right, Joanne, that the movie has a very unusual cadence. There's a very unusual rhythm to it. And there's a lot of deadpan delivery of dialogue. And there's so much stuff that you miss because it's said very seriously. And it took me a good 3, 4, 5 seconds before the joke actually sunk in. And by that time, it had actually moved on. And like you said, it kind of reminded me of, although this is a better movie, but last year at Tribeca, we saw a movie called Applesauce.
I don't think we watched that one.
I remember that one. No, I saw that one.
Yeah, so you and I saw, and that one was also kind of a murder mystery, but that was more amongst an older Jewish couples kind of group, right?
But that was a lot more hipstery.
That was more hipstery, and that was kind of going more Woody Allen-ish.
Yeah.
This one kind of... It's kind of a mish... I don't even know.
It's like a wry, dry Tina Fey, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a very dry humor.
It's the Pinot Grigio of Tina Fey humor.
Yes. But there's also this whole murder mystery built in, and there's a nod to Agatha Christie, I think, and the best thing I can say about the movie is there's really nothing quite like it. I did laugh a lot. I enjoyed it. And I think I didn't ha-ha laugh out, but I was just smiling at the wit in the movie. It's very witty.
What a delightful movie. This is my type of movie, 100%. This is quirky and weird, and it's odd, and it kind of reminded me a little bit. I think it was playing homage to Manhattan Murder. I say that in a good way. It's got some Woody Allen-esqueness about it.
Yes, I can see that.
It reminded me of a bad movie. Don't go see that one, called Wild Canaries, that had a release, I think, last year. I saw it at South by Southwest 2 years ago. And it also reminded me of a really funny movie called Summer of Blood, which I reviewed on our website, which is written by a fairly talented, I think, Turkish guy called Onur Tükel.
Who was in Applesauce.
Oh, he was in Applesauce. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. So it had this kind of interesting indie homemade, you know.
I disagree with that. This felt very, very accomplished. I mean,
no, it was accomplished, but it was kind of right in that indie niche for me.
It's very indie. You wouldn't agree?
I mean, honestly, this felt very, very polished. This script,
it was brilliant.
The script is very polished.
The script razor sharp. Fantastic.
But it was razor sharp. It was biting. Not a word was wasted in here.
No.
This is a script.
It was tight.
That has been, like, there's been love and labor poured into every single line of dialogue here, and it shows.
Yeah,
I think it's just to me, it was so finely crafted, because emotionally it took me on a lot of different journeys. I mean,
yes,
I was frightened for the characters. I thought the characters were ridiculous, but you know, I say this oftentimes, in that there's a lot of humor buried within
the truth,
the frankness, the reality of a situation, and this movie very nicely touches on that, you know, the broken relationships, you know, the friendships, everything. It's but then there's also a bizarre element within it that really throws you off base, because it doesn't quite fit into the world, and yet it does.
Yeah, and I think, Joe, you said at the beginning it's set in the LGBT genre. I hope that doesn't put off people who aren't pro LGBT to watch it, because I think this is fantastic movie making. So I think you should watch it. But I think what it does cleverly is, regardless of where it takes a stand, it's not about that. And I think what it manages to do really well is, it's about relationships, coupling, uncoupling. It's about friendships. It's about communities. It's about groups of friendships.
And I love that, because
fantastic.
I love the fact that it's an LG, basically a lesbian setting that has nothing to do with the fact that they're lesbian.
Yeah, and then there's
political statement,
right?
When you introduce,
they just happen to be,
a homosexual,
character. But, and then there's the whole femme fatale part, you know, somebody who could, who is the murderer. So it was quite that part was quite well done, I thought. I mean, honestly, this is the reason why we go to film festivals. I would ever in 100 years, this kind of a movie might just show up on some corner of Netflix, and as good as that it is, it gets pigeonholed, nobody watches it.
Yep.
It's great to be exposed to this at a film festival, so we can sing its praises and hopefully, you know, spread the word around. Women Who Kill.
Women Who Kill.
Yes.
Look out for it. I mean, really.
Otherwise known as Rashmi When She's Cold and Hungry. Kangri is how I defined it.
Rashmi, can you remind me the director's name? June.
Junger.
No.
Ingrid Jungerman.
Ingrid Jungerman. This is a talent that I think we should watch for. I don't know if this is a first movie, but.
Nope.
But,
well, she's done a lot of shorts.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this is the first feature.
I really will be looking out for her work in future.
I agree.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Movie number two then is Live Cargo.
Yes. So Live Cargo is directed by Logan Sandler, and it tells the story of Nadine, played by Dree Hemingway, and Lewis, Keith Stanfield. Oh, Keith Stanfield from Short Term 12.
Yep.
Who moved to a small Bahamian island in the Bahamas, hoping to restore the relationship in the wake of a tragedy, only to find the picturesque island torn in two, on one side a dangerous human trafficker, and on the other an aging patriarch struggling to maintain order. That sounds like a very unusual premise for a movie, but I'm intrigued. Live Cargo.
As was I, yeah. So, I mean, I read that description, and again, you know, this being a film festival, I went in slightly cold, not having prepared quite as much as I should have for the seven movies that we covered today. So this was one of the ones that I hadn't really heard or read much about prior to going in. What I'll say is that there's some real talent on show here with the filmmaking. I think the cinematography is superb. It's shot in black and white.
Wow.
Digitally, or apparently digitally, but nonetheless, the movie has a wonderful look and feel to it from a cinematography perspective. There are lots and lots of close-up shots, and to be frank, there are lots and lots of somewhat pointless shots, at least shots that were sort of lost on me, but were put in there just to show the brilliance of the person behind the camera. There's some underwater shots with some diving, but content-wise, I'm really struggling with this because this movie has a way of telling its story that was, while being very linear, almost too sparse. They don't fill in a lot of the gaps in the sense of the story doesn't seem to propel itself forward from scene to scene.
Revenant sparse?
No. A Revenant, there was a mission, right? There was an absolute directive in the movie. This had two or three different kind of subplots, which you'll get, you know, a little bit of plot.
Sounds like a Yazdi movie to me.
then some additional dialogue. So I hate to be so harsh on it, but I think plot-wise it felt very, very underwritten and underplotted more than anything. The performances throughout were a little shaky at times too. I do admire the lead actress and actor very much, particularly Keith Stanfield. We've seen him from Short Term 12 through Straight Out of Compton. He's been somebody that we followed really through film festivals as we've gone along. He's somewhat early in his career. But I felt like the clunkiness of the dialogue didn't quite give them enough to sink their teeth into. I don't know. Overall, it was kind of a disappointing movie in the sense of it just story-wise it wasn't compelling, and I think, you know, from that perspective I kind of have to you know, it makes it hard to recommend, but nonetheless, you know, beautifully shot. I think the cinematography here is excellent, and the person who did the cinematography here, Daniela Nowitz, if she hasn't done other movies, I'm certainly going to look out for her name, because this was really beautiful to look at.
Nice.
Okay.
Movie number three then is AWOL.
So AWOL, I think all three of us saw this one.
Yes.
Is directed by Deb Chauval, based on an award-winning short that she created before. So this is the feature length. And it tells the story of Joey, who is a young woman in search of direction in her small town. A visit to an army recruiting office appears to provide a path, but when she meets and falls in love with Rana, that path diverges in ways that neither woman anticipates. Director Deb Chauval crafts a clear-eyed love story and an impressive feature film debut, which, like I said, is based on the short film which won an award. So we all saw this. What do you guys think about it?
So recently we've seen Lola Kirk in Mistress America and in, if you've been following it on Amazon, Mozart in the Jungle. And this, to me, proved that this isn't just sheer luck. She is a really good actress. This is a very different Lola Kirk. So very pleased to see a non-typecast Lola Kirk in this movie. And for me, I think this is really a tragic tale about that really encapsulates, you know, what the heart wants and what goes with that. So, yeah, I think a really good movie overall. I would recommend this.
Yeah, this is Brokeback Mountain with women in small town Pennsylvania.
Yeah, good observation.
It very much had that feel to it. The movie, I think, emotionally carries is carried by Lola Kirk. I think she outshines the rest of the cast here, which
absolutely, yeah.
You know, it's clear to me that this isn't an accident that she has gone on, and I got the sense that this was perhaps an earlier movie than some of her later successes. I don't know if that's true or not, but certainly for me, it kind of underscores her, like you, Rashmi, as a bona fide actress and starlet here. And you know, overall, I think, you know, the movie was good. It had a very, you know, solid indie feeling. I think that it's not perfect. Some of the characters, particularly the final act, and I won't say more than that, but I think there was a set of circumstances and occurrences that were a little bit too much of a stretch for me. But nonetheless, it worked emotionally, and I think I went with the movie on its journey.
Yazdi. This looks like a Yazdi type of movie to me.
Carol, this movie was not.
Oh.
You know, I mean, I really, really enjoyed Carol, and you're absolutely right. This movie is the female version of Brokeback Mountain. It's about, you know, two people whose love, you know, of the same gender cannot survive in very small town kind of an environment. Really, really good acting from Lola Kirk and others. But I think the movie kind of fumbles at several places. I even found it offensive a few places. I mean, the audience that we were with, they were laughing at a couple points.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I was going to talk to you about that. I don't understand.
I didn't even know why.
I was laughing too, because really? It was awkward. It was those dialogues, what they were saying sounded like it hadn't been scripted. Every single time everybody in the audience was laughing, it was like so awkward. I was like, I can't watch this.
I disagree with you fully there. Clearly Rashmi and I are in the minority, because I actually thought there was some kind of inside joke between the group of people that were laughing. It didn't feel like it was the entire audience to me, but
yeah, there seemed like there were two pockets, but I didn't understand why.
I even commented to Rashmi, I was like, why are they laughing?
Because, and I said, I don't know.
Well, so tell us why you thought that.
Well, for one thing, the movie is, is fairly frank. There's a lot of skin in the movie.
Right. Well, it's no Blue is the Warmest Color, gets close.
That's the other thing, yes. Yeah, so this movie wants to be Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yes.
But there's a lot of skin in this movie, and frankly, some of those scenes look like porn. They don't belong in that movie. The way they have been lit, the lighting at the back, you know, the slipping of limbs on top of each other. It was. I don't know. It just felt like somebody said, this part should look like this porn movie, you know, or something. It just looked, I don't know. It didn't belong in that movie. So that's the reason why some people were giggling.
Okay.
I cannot fault the story. I think the movie actually at the end has a pretty strong punch. I really did like the ending.
Yeah, I did too.
It kind of meandered a little bit before it kind of reached its point. I also think the other reason why some of the people were laughing is because the movie does kind of make caricatures out of some of its characters.
Very much so.
You know, like small town people, and especially the husband of the other girl is such a caricature. I mean, every time he was saying something, people were laughing. Like he could not be more rednecked kind of person. So I think, you know, along those lines, people kind of had issues. And that's why I'm saying it's offensive, because it's very well intentioned and it's a good movie. I would recommend it. But in their enthusiasm to paint people a particular way, they might have gone a bit far.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the movie's biggest misstep was the portrayal of Vermont as playing lesbian capital of the world.
Yeah. I mean, see, so that was awkward.
Yeah, that was offensive.
That,
yeah,
that was just like, you know, this is lesbian heaven, and
it was
quite ridiculous. I thought that was just a misstep, and I hoped that it was not necessarily what
I think
the script
there's even
intended.
A line that says something like, this is rainbow heaven.
No, that's
something
right.
Something similar. Oh, it's wow. Horrible.
No, no, no.
Yeah,
she
that
says
was.
This was even better than the Rainbow Coalition I went to. But literally, the way it's shot is the car is driving, it says, welcome to Vermont. And the next scene is of these women, you know, in a gay bar who are, you know, playing a guitar. That's offensive.
Yeah, that is offensive. I mean, I think one thing that the movie did really well was create this incredible tension, again, that gets, the stakes get higher and higher, which I really liked.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so mixed reviews here of AWOL. I mean, I would recommend it.
It's very heartfelt.
Okay, moving on. The next movie to talk about is Parents. And I won't try and pronounce its original Danish name because it has a character in there that I don't even know how to read. But this is a movie directed by Christian Tafdrup. It is indeed a Danish movie. And it's about a middle-aged Danish couple who aren't entirely certain who they are without their son. who has recently moved away from their home. Their identities are unmoored in his absence. Attempting to recapture the vigor and magic of their younger days, they move out of their house and into the old pre-parenthood apartment where they first fell in love. So I didn't get to see this one. Yazdi and Rashmi, you two did. So what did you think?
I don't know how much to say about this movie because...
I know,
I'm kind of struggling because... it's kind of a spoiler, so I'll try not to. But there is a device in the movie which completely belabors any kind of holding in reality. But the movie just kind of goes for it. It just gleefully jumps into the surreal and somehow makes it work to a point where it is almost enjoying the fruits of that leap that it has made. And enjoying it to such a great degree that it's almost you know wallowing in it and making good fun of it. But I think at the center of the movie, it's about parents and kids. It's about you know when parents spend all their waking hours with you know rearing a child, and when that child leaves, there is a gaping emptiness, and how do you deal with it? And in the case of this couple. They decide, at least the husband decides to recreate his life when they were younger. You know, he starts right. kind of rebuying the old apartment, rebuying the old furniture, hoping to recreate the thing, recreate their past life. So that's kind of what it is in a nutshell. I really enjoyed it.
This is a mind-bending, great movie. Yeah. I think I would describe it as... a very good Twilight Zone episode it yeah. could be.
Okay.
It is at its core, and the reason why it works to Yazdi's point is because also at its core is a narrative about aging, about relationships, and about an evolution of a relationship versus recreating that relationship. And there's a subtle difference, and that's what it explores. There's almost something Freudian about it, in terms mm-hmm. of relationships between mothers and sons, fathers and sons.
Is it trippy? Because I'm getting
no,
trippy.
Okay. No.
Easy to understand.
I think in the hands of Hollywood, it could have been trippy.
Yeah.
I don't want to say more than that, but I would say that I hope Hollywood doesn't make a recreation of this because it would turn into something horrible. But this is a phenomenal, unusual movie that will get under your skin.
Yeah, it makes this metaphysical leap, but it has no interest in really explaining that leap or why
it
happened.
And
it
doesn't need to.
It doesn't need to. It just is interested in the consequences of that. You know, in many ways, it reminded me of that Duplass Brothers movies, You're the One I Love.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes,
the One I Love.
The One I Love.
Yes.
Elizabeth.
Yes. Elizabeth Moss. And
Jay Duplass.
Yes.
It reminded me partly of It's a Wonderful Life. So it's got kind of these, it's got all of these little pieces and it's all put together very well and it's acted remarkably well. Five actors, I think, totally, if that.
Yeah.
But it does have a lot to say about exactly what Rashmi said, which is the thrill of a new love versus the gold of something which is accumulated over years.
Yeah, and I think...
And the folly in trying to weigh one over the other.
Okay.
But it's also about the unintended consequences. Joe, I know you love that whole issue of unintended consequences of getting what you wish for.
Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
That sounds
and
like
it slides
a great
so
movie.
Easily into the absurd and comes right back out.
And it doesn't matter.
Without a flair. Yeah, without a so it's
brilliant.
Very good.
Foreign language movie.
Very good.
From Denmark. Brilliant.
Parents. Terrific.
Yes.
Next movie on the list is I'll Sleep When I'm Dead.
Okay. So I'll Sleep When I'm Dead is directed by Justin Crook. And it's from producers Matthew Weaver, Matt Colon, Happy Walters, and David Guile. Somebody named their son Happy. it is an energetic, heart-pumping documentary about one of the most eminent DJs working today, Steve Aoki. And in the lead-up to Aoki's biggest show of his career, the doc examines the driving force behind his passion. Rocky Aoki, Daredevil Showman, Benihana Founder, and Steve's absent father are all there. So I presume, Joe, you saw this one?
Both Rashmi and I did, yeah. It was the first film that we saw today. So, I mean, in, to read you what I wrote when I left the movie is something, it's slightly an unfair statement, but in many ways, this is kind of Jiro dreams of DJing. And I don't mean to draw such parallels between the movies, but I think it's another one of these kind of DJ rockumentary type movies, which, you know, shows somebody who is incredibly driven. The parallels with Jiro, to my mind, come in the father-son relationship. And although the father isn't really portrayed in this movie because he had since passed when the movie is shot, he's very much a character in the movie that drives the central protagonist, Steve Aoki, who, as much as I'm into electronic dance music, I'm not familiar with a lot of his music, but it certainly shows a terrific portrayal of this guy who is relentless in his pursuit of DJing excellence. And I think more than anything, I'm not, again, not too familiar with his music and his personal success, but, you know, to me, when I look at what he is doing in this movie, he's portrayed certainly more as driven than talented, but nonetheless, what he's achieved and what he continues to do with his life is remarkable. And I love this type of stuff. You know, this is MTV rockumentary behind the music done well.
Yeah, so
before you go, it's funny you should mention Jiro Dreams of Sushi, because one of the producers in the movie, David Gelb, also produced Jiro Dreams of Sushi. So
basically, last year at Tribeca, Joe and I watched the movie As I Am, The Life and Times of DJ AM. And this is similar in a sense, because it's a story about people who are broken, but use their brokenness in some ways to channel it in something positive and become these forces of nature. And there's a quote in the movie that says, Steve has an abundance of personality, and that clearly comes across in this documentary. For me, I like what you said, Joe, about the father-son relationship, but I think at its core, it's about chasing a ghost, right? It's about Steve Aoki chasing this ghost of his father, in a sense, who was this larger-than-life character. And what resonated with me the most is that whole father relationship, because, you know, as I've said many times on the show, my father was a central part of my life, and certainly a missing part of my life now that he's gone. And so I really resonate with those movies that managed to capture that so well. And I think that did capture it and so well.
We shouldn't fail to mention that Steve Aoki is the son of Rocky Aoki, who famously founded the Benihana chain.
Right.
And went on to
the hot air ballooning.
Tremendous success. He actually failed just prior to Richard Branson going across the Pacific in the previous movie that I mentioned. But he was also into speedboats and, you know, he was just a larger-than-life character. And I think Steve very much lived in his shadow and wanted to rise up above that.
And was abandoned by his father, right? So there's all those issues of
abandoned in the sense of his father was always running the business. And he said in the movie, you know, his business was first.
His health was second.
Health was second. And then third priority for him was his family, which is kind of a shame given that he had two separate families, of which Steve was one of the members of the first.
And the quote, "I'll sleep when I'm dead," is actually from his father. So I think it's a very interesting homage to his father, but it's also portraying this person who is incredibly driven. And of course, I love electronic dance music. I love the fact that this is a guy, you know, electronic dance music has been in Europe for many, many, many years. And so I think for someone who's not European to break into that European scene and make it so big is incredible, right? That's not an accident, Joe, to your point about talent. He is clearly talented. And there's a lot of other DJs like Tiesto and Pete Tong and others who are almost a little bit, I think, envious of the success that Steve Aoki has had in recent years.
But I think they're making the point that it's his drive that gets him rather than more talent.
Yeah. Very good. Very, very good. I love this stuff.
One little niggle is that the movie, in its last 10 minutes, then turns the focus around to his mother.
Who, it's like, oh yeah, and
I feel like it was very much an afterthought when you look at the way that, you know, there are clips of her kind of dotted throughout the movie. The more interesting story there was perhaps her mother's relentless support and love of him and his endeavors, which filled in and in many ways compensated for the lack of approval and the lack of recognition that he was seeking from his father. So I feel like that could have been perhaps a little bit more interesting to explore. But that's just a minor niggle.
Okay. Yeah. I love that this is really about someone who is an heir of adrenaline, of someone, you know, like, I am the heir of adrenaline.
But he's very admirable. And his motto of, you know, by any means necessary, you know, he has this little tattoo there. You can really see that he believes in that.
Yeah.
He will get what he wants by any means necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. But then there's this underlying theme of, like, starve the ego, feed the soul, which, again, I really connected with. Mm.
Moving along, the next movie is Here Alone.
Okay, so Here Alone is about a young woman who struggles to survive on her own in the wake of a mysterious epidemic that has decimated society and forced her deep into the unforgiving wilderness. This sounds a little bit like we just watched a movie.
Everything Else.
Yeah.
I don't know.
and it's directed by Rod Blackhurst. It's written by David Ebeltoft. And it stars Holly Adams, Abel McShorley Bradshaw, Jonathan Gundle, a whole bunch of, it seems, new people, Joe.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any of the actors in the movie. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think the performance in this movie are fine. Unfortunately, this just brings nothing new to the genre. We have the infected instead of the, you know, the zombies. So these aren't undead. This is some virulent outbreak that has, you know...
Is it like Outbreak?
Catastrophized the Earth. It feels very much like 28 Days Later in terms of the world. And, you know, again, we have these fast-running...
Oh, well, fast-running zombies, yay!
You know, bloodthirsty creatures. And I just... thought that, you know, this movie does a really nice setup. It takes its time. It tells its story in terms of what happened to the main protagonist and why she is left alone in flashback. She's a very strong heroine. She's very resourceful. And I admired all of those elements of the character. But ultimately, the movie felt like it didn't really go anywhere. And the kind of slow burn that you have here should lead to some kind of finale or payoff. And, you know, there is some drama inserted into the final 10 minutes of the movie in order to try and give us that big ending.
Is there tension?
And there's tension. I mean, the scary moments are done well. The monsters are appropriately fearsome. You know, they're frightening. They are infectious. So you have to be careful about wearing a mask. And the movie does its best to gross you out with, you know, one of the ways that you can defend yourself against being tracked by these things is to smear yourself in excrement of rabbits. And yeah, so the movie really does go to some really quite vomit inducing places. Again, I just felt that this movie just it should have, whenever you're doing one of these zombie things, these post-apocalyptic things, you know, insert some elements of character that we haven't seen before. But we've seen this before, and maybe not so much with a female protagonist, but it just felt derivative in every which way. That's not to say that the movie is unaccomplished. I think it's well shot. I think it's well told. I think the story is reasonably well executed. The zombies are okay. But it's ultimately just a little too flat to bring anything new. So, you know, back of an airplane type stuff. But, yeah. I mean, you know, not something I would recommend that you run out and watch, unfortunately.
And you went to that instead of Little Boxes.
I did indeed. Yeah, I had a few minutes and I thought, well, let me just, because we aren't already covering enough movies at this film festival, I thought I would pop along and see that one. Because I am, you know, zombies are something that I like. I mean, it's a genre that I generally enjoy. So
down to our last movie for the day.
Indeed, Little Boxes.
Little Boxes.
Which is a comedy directed by Rob Meyer. The movie stars our friend Melanie Lynskey, that we speak about a lot on Movie While Us, along with
fondness.
Nelson Ellis, Armani Jackson, Una Lawrence. But the basic premise here is that it's the summer before sixth grade, and Clark is the new in town biracial kid in a sea of white. Discovering that to be cool, he needs to act more than black, he fumbles to meet expectations, while his urban intellectual parents, Mac and Gina, also strive to adjust to small town living. So, guys, what did you think of Little Boxes?
I really like this movie. I think it could have been a little tighter, but overall, I think it was a really sweet, interesting portrayal of this biracial couple that we haven't seen on big screen before or as commonly, and it had great performances. And I think what it did is, in some ways, it kind of did what AWOL did, I think, almost did an offensive portrayal of suburbia. It kind of felt like the anti-suburbia movie. Like, if you watch this movie, you'll be like, I am never moving to small town America. Like, I'm only staying in the cities if you're a city person. So it did nothing for the reputation of, you know, small towns. But I think what it captured for me was, you know, we think of cities as being these places where kids are going to go awry. And really, it's the pollution in these small towns where kids go awry, where there's actually nothing to do and there isn't culture and there isn't big-minded thinking. So it definitely played to that trope of small-town thinking, small-minded, and this is set in Rome, Washington.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a truth to that. I mean, the setup is hilariously close to my own personal situation growing up in a small town being of mixed race. So that's...
Yeah, and that's kind of why I wanted to see it, Joe. It did remind me a little bit of your youth as you tell me about it, with, you know, educated parents and your experiences in that small town. I think it did a good job.
Yasdi, what do you think of it?
So at every film festival, I'm always looking for that one movie which will just blow me away, just like punch me in the face. And I think this movie comes the closest to doing that. This is by a wide mile the best movie I've seen so far.
Wow. Really? Yeah.
I really loved it. And I, you know, this is not something that I've necessarily gone through. But I just like the authenticity of this story. I like how it's handled. It's handled with so much respect. And
yes,
everything that Rashmi said, at its core, it's a sweet little movie about a biracial couple and their son moving from Brooklyn, New York to a small town, Rome, in the state of Washington. That's all the movie is about. But it treats all of those characters, the father, the son, the mother, with so much honesty, and it looks at them. And I think, unlike AWOL, it's not necessarily mocking those suburbanites, but I think it is making the case for how America's culture and America's creativity is being mainstreamed in suburbia and being diluted, you know, where everybody's doing the same thing, everybody has to conform, and we are kind of losing, you know, any sense of newness or culture, you know, or cultural
innovation.
And it does, and the reason why I love this movie so much is it does one of the things which is so difficult to do in movies, and it's absolutely a hot potato and most people stay away from it, which is teen sexuality. You know, and it does it...
Tween.
Like,
yeah.
These are very... This boy is what, 12?
11.
11 or 12. And it handles that whole part so beautifully, even as it makes you uncomfortable.
Yes.
It's not judging any of those characters. It is real. It also does this great job of talking about the intersection of class and economics. You know, even in this small town, people want to be good to this guy who is black and his wife is white, but they can't help, you know, letting little things slip in. But they're different.
Right.
And it's just written so beautifully. And
ignorance. And, right? Yeah, it's not racism. It's ignorance. So it plays with ignorance really well, and it's not manipulative. It's actually very funny. Yeah. There are some parts that are laugh out loud funny. It's actually a dramedy more than an outright comedy, I would say. But it's got this beautiful heart, and the kid,
Armani Jackson.
He is phenomenal.
He's incredible.
Phenomenal. That's one to watch.
Yeah. And Melanie Lynskey. I mean, I'm just thanking the movie gods that somebody is continuing to give her lead roles because she's so good.
And typecast, but not so bad as in she normally gets that mother role. There's a bit more meat to the bones here.
Household name.
Yeah.
I think she's deliberately taking small roles in big films and big roles in small films, but she's, you know, I don't know whether that's a deliberateness in the type of work she wants to do and is interested in, or whether it's just, you know, the big studios aren't calling her, but she's such a fantastic actress.
She's so authentic. I think that's what she's in this movie.
And everybody's kind of judging the others. The father who's black is just as quick to make some judgments as the other town people who are not black. And it kind of plays along how we all can make mistakes under certain circumstances. And it does it with so much honesty. And I can give this movie no more praise than to say that I wanted to spend so much more time with this family. I really grew to love these three people. And I could have easily watched another 3 hours of what happens next in their life in this particular town.
Yeah.
Only minor step is there is a set of closing out scenes in the movie which are completely unnecessary. They almost cheapen the movie to a little bit, but, you know, minor niggle. But it's my kind of movie. Such a great film. I'm going to champion this movie for a long, long time. Little Boxes.
It's cute.
Terrific.
I didn't love it as much as Yazdi, but it's very good and it's very sweet.
And can you give away the reasoning behind the name without spoiling the movie?
It's a move.
It's, so nothing's working for them during the move. Major part being that their furniture and all this stuff is coming in boxes and it's not arriving. And he's talking with the driver and making the driver more and more angry. So the driver is more pissed off. So eventually when the driver comes, through a series of circumstances, they don't happen to be at the house. So the driver leaves all these boxes on their front lawn. So they're stuck with little boxes in their front.
But I wonder if it's also a metaphor for how people put things in boxes and compartmentalize and stereotype. And really it plays with our expectation of stereotype. Yeah.
There's a great line where the father tells his biracial kid that you can't treat people like their groups. You treat people like their individuals. And that really resonated for me. But anyway.
Terrific stuff. So, day.
Phew!
I know, the end of day three of our coverage of Tribeca Film Festival. We've got one more day here before we have to head off back to San Diego. But, you know, if you are in the New York area, you've got a good week and a half left of this. So get your butt down to this film festival and see some of these premieres. Tickets are available online. And
they're selling out. They are selling out quickly. So, yes.
Yeah. No, and that's a great thing. I think everyone like us is tired of the, you know, the umpteenth usual Batman versus Superman and sequelitis that's going on out there. So film festivals are a terrific antidote.
So favorite top two movies of everything you've seen so far, Joe?
You know, it's a tricky one. I think both have to be the documentaries. I mean, I really did enjoy Don't Look Down, the Richard Branson balloon movie. I also really enjoyed Do Not Resist. I think those certainly were the two most memorable and impactful films that I've seen. But
yes, we heard of one of yours. What's your other?
Yeah, so for me, it would be Little Boxes and I'm going to cheat and say it's a tie between the two foreign
films. Oh, you can't tie.
The two foreign films I saw, Mother and Parents. They're almost the same movie. Oh. Mother and Parents. Mother is part of Parents. But if I was forced to, I would say Parents and Little Boxes.
So I'm going to go with Yazdi. Parents is getting up there for me. And I think the documentary First Monday in May still is resonating with me.
Even more so than After Spring?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good stuff. Let's wrap up for
today. I think it's because it's more universal.
Okay.
Mail at movieworldlaws.com, instagram.com/movieworldlaws, facebook.com/movieworldlaws, twitter.com/movieworldlaws. Lots of good ways to find out what we're up to. We are posting throughout the festival, so do stay tuned. Until our next episode, it's Too Many Movies, Too Little Time. A good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.